Hey, Dr. Ben, whenever you're ready.
Hang on, let me see what I got.
Carl?
Yeah, you sound loud and clear. I appreciate the fact you got a microphone.
Yep. My wife set me up on this. I have no idea what I'm doing, so I think it'll work.
No. And what I've learned is audio is much more important. You know, you can have a great conversation and people love the information, but if the audio isn't clear, you're wasting everybody's time. And it's very unfortunate because I've heard great interviews, really hard to understand. But no, kudos to your wife because it's a really nice group.
All right. Am I in focus here?
Yeah, you're good. So as much as we can see each other, I'm not going to use the video. It's just between you and I. I'm just using the audio afterwards.
No problem.
Well, you've got a lot of people. I just want to chat for a second. You got a lot of people excited, which is nice. Some people have sent me some questions, but I'm probably going to preempt all that because I have my own questions.
And you
want to go through some of
the things. A couple things. I listened to your review of West Palm. My last name is Bocchicchio.
I know. I learned that now.
That's why I use Dr. Ben or Dr. Bo or whatever. Yeah. It's easier. And one other thing, Doug McGuff, I did not teach Doug McGuff this. I actually taught Ken Hutchins.
Okay.
Who's the guy who actually exposed McGuff to this stuff.
Gotcha.
Okay. But McGuff's background, really most of his physiology came from his medical training. And it looks to me like his own reading. But as far as the system, it's my system. But he learned it from Ken Hutchins, who was a college kid when I described it to him when I first started. And then about 7 years later, he wrote the book Super Slow.
That's funny. So you kind of watched the history. You watched the ripple of your information kind of like go through the pipeline, right?
Yeah. No. So, I mean, a bunch of people, when the book came out, said, hey, there's a book about your system. I said, oh, that's cool. And then Kenny Hutchins sent me a book and he said, thank you, you know, for making me listen. And on the first page of his Super Slow instruction manual, he said he didn't invent it. He said Vince Bocchicchio from New York was the guy who did it, whatever. Anyway.
Right. No, good. I appreciate that. I remember you telling me that.
Just so.
And I go, I didn't know the Ken, but I knew the Doug, but I appreciate it. I'll straighten that up too.
Yeah, not a problem.
Well, that's good. So what I thought I'd do is like, there's parts of what I've learned, and I've rewatched your presentation at two locations, because it's amazing as much as me sitting and being present for that lecture. And I asked some of the questions in the end, listening to it a second time through, it's like, wow, this is a whole new layer of understanding, especially after reading some and so on. And then I saw an ad that was on the local TV network in Phoenix that went to your facility. I don't know how long ago this is, in the last 5 years. And I mean, you were on it, but it kind of reviewed the smart system, and you took a patient, you had a few people down there. Then you walked to the other end of the hall and you had a guy lying down who was going through vascular massage.
The ECP. Yeah.
So I'll want you to talk about that later because that seemed pretty fascinating. And I know it was too much to talk about at the conference, but it's like the simplicity of the whole thing, the way it fits into low carb. It's like, wow.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a machine that was designed years ago for congestive heart failure patients. Okay. So what it basically does, it augments venous return. Mm-hmm. So instead of, think about it this way, at least I do, the musculature of the venous system fails, basically. It can't pump blood back in congestive heart failure, right? So what happens is you augment them externally. So you hook up to an EKG with these series of cuffs. And when you're in diastole, it picks up diastole, it sequentially squeezes from bottom up. And so it augments venous return.
Right.
So you augment venous return, you increase end diastolic pressure, okay? Right. And that fills the heart more significantly, the Starling's law, it fills more significantly. And then when it pumps against less resistance because we've uploaded the return pressure. So less resistance, a more filled ventricle. So squeezes more volume at a higher rate through less resistance, creates shear force on the endothelium, and that produces nitric oxide.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's Right. Yeah, that's it. And that's the elixir of circulation and youth and everything else. But so it does it mechanically. So that company approached me and said, you know, can you, and I said, you know, this physiology sounds a lot like high intensity exercise, you know, the mechanism. And so they said, can you think of other uses for this other than acute angina and congestive heart failure? And I said, and I started using it on elite athletes, on triathletes and stuff for recovery. Yep. And that's a great use. And I think for diabetics, this thing would be phenomenal because you basically have a vascular disease, right? A vascular inhibition. And this thing, you know, dilates capillaries like crazy. So anyway, that's the reason. And I think I'm one of the only, if not the only non-cardiologist that has that machine in the country. So it's kind of cool.
Excellent. That's excellent. So to put that in after working out, so somebody worked out in the other.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Clinic.
Does everybody file down and do their 20 minutes on that vascular massage table, or is it sort of
not everybody? No, in fact, I don't use it that much, but I do use it for people for example, pulmonary patients who can't, and even though our exercise we can kind of manage through that, but they can't exercise because they are restricted with breathing. On this machine, you can get the vascular benefit of exercise without increasing, in fact, probably decreasing respiratory rate. Okay. And then the other interesting mechanism is, you know, the X number of beats per minute is cardio and it improves your heart. Actually, on this thing, you increase stroke volume. You actually probably decrease heart rate, but you get a vascular benefit at least comparable to exercise. So really interesting. So you just, you know, it's mechanically augmented stuff, but again, I follow the pathways. You know, what are the pathways that these things are instigating, and are they beneficial? And how, if there are there other ways to instigate them, and get over hurdles that might be present, right? So
absolutely. I mean, you always called yourself sort of a minimalist. And it's like It just seems so powerful to have these two together.
Yeah.
I hope Doug has you back to talk more about that because, you know, half of the audience there—I don't know about half, but third to half the audience were physicians, and they're looking for how to implement low carb. You went beyond that and gave them something to implement, you know, that they can have their patients take home. There's really no reason not to do it. And your book is about, you can work with a person in a wheelchair, you can work with Charles Barkley, you can, et cetera, et cetera. And so when you add in the vascular massage table, it's like, that's transformative.
Yeah, no, it's a powerful combination. And I called it, you know, cutesy. I called it a metabolic makeover because I think that's what people are trying to do. They're trying to change their metabolism. If you really get down to the nitty gritty, what are we trying to do? Weight loss, reversing diabetes. I mean, this is all just metabolically changing metabolically, right?
Yep.
I mean, that's what we're trying to instigate. So,
Got to end this. Let me just kick this off.
Yeah.
Audio guy, I can chop and put it back in because I don't want to draw out so much good information before we get talking. I have plenty of questions.
Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you in understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath.
Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. Today we have an outstanding opportunity for an interview with Dr. Venkikio, Vince Venkikio, once a Staten Island boy from the Northeast, now living in the Southwest. And his life, I don't know why I didn't know him until now, but in my mind, he's a combination between an MD. He's a double PhD and a master's. He's not an MD, but he's between an MD, Jacqueline, and everything else you want to know about physical fitness. That's the way I look at it. So, Dr. Venn.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. So I want to start off by, you know, we talked a few things, talked briefly last time about a week ago, that you and I had this conversation. Somebody who had called you and said, you know, this person has this, I don't know, $11 million grant on exercise and low carb for, I think, can't remember if it was diabetes.
Fatty liver,
right?
Yeah.
And you had these two patients, that person had the two patients said, you know, they couldn't do the diet, but they did the exercise part. And they got some good results. This sort of sets the stage we can talk about. How'd that go over? What was that about?
Okay. Elizabeth Parks, Dr. Elizabeth Parks is an academic research person, you know, no skin in the game. She's not selling anything. She's just trying to accumulate data. So she got a $3 million grant from NIH to study fatty liver disease, which is now, you know, very prevalent and becoming epidemic. And it all stems from, you know, overload of carbohydrate and insulin resistance and the same basic mechanism that causes a lot of our metabolic disorders. Anyway, so she told me she was using a protocol of treatment of high intensity interval training, HIIT, and low carb eating. And I didn't get the specific details, but I was assuming, and I'm pretty sure as far as the high intensity exercise, she was doing the standard intermittent jogging, running, or in this case, probably walking up an incline, then slower, or bicycle pedaling faster, and then 60-second or whatever it is recovery time. So intervals for the, but what they call high intensity, so it's not sustained. And just by definition for everybody out there, if it's high intensity, it has to be by definition interval training, because you cannot sustain true high intensity exercise for a long duration. If you can't, those things are mutually exclusive. They're dichotomous, so when they go in a different direction. Mm-hmm. So if you're training, I was telling the story this today to some of my patients. I said, guy came in and told me, oh, I like high intensity exercise. I know you do that. He says, I do that 3 times a week. I said, well, that's a lot. I said, how long is your session? He said, 90 minutes. I said, well, sorry, that's not high intensity. I said, you would have been dead, you know, 40 minutes into the deal years ago. But in any, so my point is you cannot really instigate high intensity effort and sustain it for more than a minute and a half or so. And so therefore a routine would have to be interval in nature. Does that make sense? Sure. So, yeah. And I try to tell people that, and that's what we basically do now. So anyway, she said that the two gals, one was cirrhotic, I believe, had cirrhosis, and the other one had pretty advanced non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And they didn't really adhere to the low-carb protocol as they wanted in any case, but they did not miss a training session over this 12-week period, and they both reversed significantly, statistically significantly, their conditions. And these people are doing ultrasounds and biopsy. I mean, they're doing some heavy-duty, you know, data study. So anyway, she was surprised, and I said, geez, that's surprising. And I've been studying exercise, you know, for 50 years, and I said, wow. Then I went into the literature, and I found that there is some data showing that high intensity exercise as a singular protocol can reverse and improve the condition of the liver. But then if you think about it, Carl, it makes sense, because why is the liver fatty in the first place? Because it's being inundated with sugar that is supposed to turn into fat, you know, de novo lipogenesis, right? And it's like, wow, okay, now we're taking the load off, because what we're doing is we're increasing the muscle's capacity to store glycogen, because what's your biggest storage center? Skeletal muscles and liver. And so you're taking the load off the liver. So now it's not inundated with having to store sugar. It's less insulin resistant. And now it can send the fat to fat tissue, which before it couldn't. It became inundated with its own fat. You know, it's human foie gras, you know. So this is basically the mechanism. And now after the fact, it makes sense, although I never really thought of it as a singular treatment for fatty liver disease.
So what I love about that is, like, it shows how important it lined it all up, whether it was HIT. I think HIT goes beyond that, but it's the consumer. Yeah. Now made the biggest consumer glucose, whether it's glycogen or whatnot. It's like you've now really revved it up. So I would think that HIT, we'll talk about it, is even more so, because it has such an extended effect well beyond the time that you're doing it. And that's
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know what's interesting? I was listening to Peter Attia, who I know Peter fairly well, and one of his blogs, and they were talking about how you know, hormonal secretions are not necessarily steady state. They have, you know, highs and lows, and you know, they're sporadic, basically. You know, you'll have a high of like HGH, and you'll have a high of glucagon, whatever. So, and so I was thinking, you know, we're trying to instigate, and we are instigating measurably, some hormonal responses. So what are the metabolic responses to high intensity exercise? And the reason that we don't do them, I think, another reason maybe is that on a steady basis, you become inured to that, and it's not like the natural impulse and pulsating kind of release of hormones. So this twice a week thing, as I back into it and I kind of reverse engineer why this thing works, it seems like that's pretty, there's another reason now why this thing works. And I think why the recovery, if you don't do anything of a high intensity nature in between, is more complete. And the upward adaptation has a chance to occur.
I agree. When you came down to the more or less twice a week, I mean, what I'm saying is, I'm getting older anyway, is that that response, that resting response rate, that repair response rate, whatever we want to call it, pretty vital. You mentioned in the talk that I attended that 48 to 60 hours, you know, it's, and I would say you, people should not take that lightly. It's like you go
home, of course,
and go do activity, as in your sense of the word.
Yes.
Activity, but, you know, I don't want to see you back in the gym. But, you know, certainly don't come back here.
Not working that hard. Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah, that's counterproductive. That's trying to get a suntan, staying in the sun 5 days in a row, 5 hours in the middle of the day. You cannot adapt to that stimulus. You need time to adapt to that. The same thing with exercise.
It's true. I would almost poke them in the eye with something like, you know, rhabdomyolysis by saying, you know, your muscles have to repair, sir, honey, whatever. And if you're not letting that happen, you're actually setting yourself up for a problem. You know, you're
sure. Yeah, it's too much stimulus, and you can't respond to that much stimulus. And, you know, it's at best non-productive, but probably counterproductive, and in most cases, sure. And again, the interesting thing about high intensity exercise is the stronger and more fit you are, the less of it you can take. So see if that sounds counterintuitive. Okay, if I get a rehab patient, it's got a just newly repaired limb, I could probably train them 7 days a week on that limb, because they aren't capable with that compromised limb of inducing an inroad into their recovery ability. All right. They just can't do it. I take a super strong conditioned athlete. They can almost kill themselves. That's how strong their impetus is and their metabolic upheaval becomes. So I have to be real careful with my really strong elite athletes that they recover from the twice a week. Okay. So, and it sounds, again, counterproductive, but the fitter and stronger you are, the less of this you can tolerate.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. It makes me think actually of patients that are in the 50s, 60s, women in particular, and they're saying, you know, I can never, you know, build muscle. And you tell them, I haven't told them about your program particularly, but I thought I could about HIT. And, you know, and it's like, you know, I've been doing that and I just don't see any difference. And I'm thinking, well, does this person not know really how to put the whole threshold thing that we'll talk about later?
Mm-hmm.
Have they never gotten the threshold? Is that what I'm looking at? They just, you know, they're not comfortable pushing themselves. But you kind of gave me another perspective here, is that, you know, it takes a while to get that way, to get to the point that they now know what that feeling is, I guess. I don't know.
Sure. Well, most people haven't had the opportunity or the necessity to push their muscle systems to those limits. Because, you know, again, this whole exercise physiology and that chart I have in the book and the chart I showed in the demo and the talk was that's which muscle fibers are we recruiting for what length of time? And then again, we will talk about threshold, but any prescription of behavior, pharmacological prescription, whatever it might be, has to reach a threshold level in response in order for it to be effective. 10 milligrams of a drug that requires 100 milligrams probably isn't going to get the job done. Why? Because it hasn't met the chemical threshold for efficacy, for you know, being efficient.
Right.
And so the same thing with exercise. Certain of these muscle fiber types that we have, the ones that support walking and mild levels of what I call activity as opposed to exercise, do not instigate at the level necessary the chemical responses to drive an upward adaptation in muscle protein synthesis, meaning muscle building, and in certain muscle activity, which drive mitochondria, these little batteries that we're looking to improve as far as voltage, okay, mm-hmm. power. They just don't drive those things because the body is only going to respond to that which it has to respond to. It's going to try to drive homeostasis, which means its main thrust is to maintain the status that we're in. And so we have to coerce it. And that's coming from an Italian from New York. We have to coerce it a little bit, you know. So
I'm married to a Sicilian, so we know about coercion. You know?
Yeah, okay, you understand.
Yeah, absolutely. But that is such a key ingredient that, you know, as I got into this, and there was a point of where I thought I was with HIT, and what you made very clear is that now you have to get a threshold. You did your story of the man with the 4 cigarettes, you know, he wants to stop smoking, he gets down to 2, and he goes, that's a great effort, you know, 100% for your effort, but it's not going to be effective. You didn't reach that threshold.
Right.
And that's just like myself and others. It's like, yeah, I went into the gym a number of times and I thought I pushed hard, but no, you have to push to that point that it's life or death, baby. You must know that in your bones, you know? And that is so, you know, that whole idea of first, yeah, it's uncomfortable and it's a little bit disorienting. But as you talked to whoever it was, you said, I'm creating a crisis. I'm creating a controlled emergency in which I'm there helping to direct it, but that's what has to happen.
Right.
You know,
Think about it. And again, now understanding, rather than scaring people away, understanding that for somebody who hasn't done this before, it doesn't take that much. Those fibers are going to kick in because relative to what you've done, if you're sedentary, you haven't done much relative to that. It may take a very moderate, objectively moderate level of impetus input. To get you to those muscles, those type 2B muscle fibers, those life or death muscle fibers, because for you, I mean, your muscle system is untrained and hasn't been exposed to any kind of real effort, relative effort, or let's say genetically what your genetic potential might be and effort potential. And so you haven't gone there. Well, why would you? You know, you're not running away from a predator and you don't have to take down a water buffalo to eat tomorrow. So why would you? But you can learn it quickly. And it is innate. The mom has the baby under the car kind of a thing.
Right.
And you're going to get to that adrenaline response. You're going to lift up the Volkswagen. Okay. And that's kind of an autonomic, that's a response that's going to happen. Okay. But in most cases, we don't reach that amount of threat or intensity in our muscular effort requirement.
Not at all. Not at all. I just think it's genius. I mean, a lot of light bulbs went on. I know that was your metaphor, the Christmas tree. Light bulb went on in terms of understanding. I want to go back though, actually in your life. So Staten Island boy, and I mean, you hit the road with such clarity of asking the right questions at the right time for you to develop a pretty basic system that you stay to, and then you added some things on. So can we go back there where the genesis in your life was? Because I think that's a pretty important story.
Okay, a little bit. My history and my family, we've had a history of people that are scientists and are into physical training. Okay, I had an uncle who was, and this is for the older audience, he was the manager and trainer of Jersey Joe Walcott, who was a heavyweight champion boxer. And I used to go to the fights and see these guys and then watch them train these guys. I had another uncle who trained with, and these guys were called physical culturists back in the 30s and 40s, who trained with Angelo Siciliano, who we know better as Charles Atlas. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he was one of his training partners. He also became a physiologist. So I got this kind of background, and a couple of my uncles were coaches. And anyway, so I got into it, and my father had a set of weights that he used to take the fire department test. My father had a law degree, got recruited for World War II, went to Okinawa, came back out and became a firefighter in New York. But he had a set of weights that he used for the test down my basement in Staten Island. And I was fascinated with these things. I still have them. There was a set of weights that Charles Atlas and my uncle had a blacksmith make them. They were hand-casted, okay? And so anyway, I got fascinated. My father wouldn't let me do it until I got to be like 13. He said, and I'm going to teach you how to do this so you don't get hurt. So everything was slow, controlled, real, what we called back then, you know, good form. You wouldn't jerking around and twisting and stuff. And I felt, man, this stuff is if you do it that way, it's tough, and it felt cool. And I responded pretty well, you know, having one of those fifth grade Italian bodies with a mustache and a cigar. And but anyway, so I developed pretty quickly, and I was always a jock, a really pretty high level athlete. Yeah. And I was fascinated by the training part of this stuff. So I went to college. I went to Ithaca and got my degree in physical education, health, and science. Then I got a master's in kinesiology, PhD in muscle physiology, another PhD in health, because the health thing started to become pretty evident to me. This stuff was not just for elite athletes. So I wanted to develop a system that was just absolutely minimalistic, so athletes could be in season and still train and not be overworked. And so I met Arthur Jones, the Nautilus guy, okay, as a grad student in Florida. Just everything is, you know, serendipity. And he explained all this stuff to me. And then I started to ask him questions. And then as far as the slow training, this is a little thorn in my craw. A little. Some people say, well, you didn't invent slow training. I said, well, at the time that I created it and used it, Arthur Jones, Ellington Darden, Ken Hutchins, none of these guys had ever heard of it. And if it had happened before, it was, you know, I was like Columbus. I didn't know that the Scandinavians landed first and whatever. I didn't know. I thought I made it up, and I think I really did make the system. I developed the system. But the key to that was I asked Arthur Jones in these Nautilus machines with these cams that were asymmetrical that varied the resistance according to supposedly the perfect strength curve for each muscle. Yeah. They developed a resistance curve to meet that. Yeah. 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 And he said they developed them isometrically. So I took that thought and said, isometric is no speed. So the slower I go, the closer I go to zero speed isometrically, the better I will take advantage of these cams. That was the germ that got me started on slow training. That was it. That's how it started. And if anybody has a better story, let me know. But that's really how it happened.
On that thought, while you're talking about that, you mentioned in one of your videos too, and you've talked about the resistance curve that primarily any machine has, whether it was Nautilus initially and now they're all kind of a variation per mile view of that. And each person has their own strength curve, and you're trying to finagle the two because not everybody fits the machine because we're all different. Some might be perfect. What is that? That's a great little concept there. Strength curve.
Well, yeah, it's something that I have never seen anybody write about or talk about. Is so even with a barbell or a dumbbell, you have a resistance curve has to do with leverage and torque and things like, in other words, say you would do a dumbbell curl. You know, at 90 degrees, that thing is way effective and difficult because the resistance of gravity is linear straight up and down. And now we are actually pulling straight up and down in that couple of inches. Okay. When you start a curl, you can move 4 or 5 inches in the rotational arc of the movement, but only raise the weight 1 inch vertically. So it's only 1/4 effective. Therefore, stronger, or you can demonstrate your strength in a stronger manner because of the leverage and the fulcrum and the physics involved. So what Arthur Jones tried to do was to make machines that would meet that curve, or an ideal or a median kind of a strength curve for each movement, and make a machine. So what I'm saying is, like you just discussed, it's not perfect for everybody, obviously, because everybody has different length bones and attachments and insertions and origins. So what I try to do is to match. What we're trying to do is to keep a constant load on the muscle. That's one of the elements of smart training. So in order to that load to be high constantly, we have to try to match the resistance curve that the machine allows us with our own strength curve. So there are little maneuvers and subtleties that happen posturally with speed variation. This is getting a little deep, but in any case, we want to try to match those so we have a constant high intensity load. And the reason we want constancy is because, again, within 3 seconds of resting or a diminution of the resistance, we can get recovery of 50%. We don't really want to recover. We want to build these metabolites, this chemical stuff that builds up this soup, okay? We want to build that to this threshold level wherein we will fail mechanically, and it correlates metabolically to this threshold level, which will stimulate an upward progression in our capacity, strength, energy, things like that.
Right. So speaking of the 3 seconds, it's neat you said that. I didn't hear that before, but I was watching when you were working closely with Doug, for instance, that and older woman, and that you're saying, nope, don't rest, down, get up, down, you know, get to the feet, down, slow, you know, don't hang around up there. And then you reference that, you know, the mind wants to go to a place, or the muscle wants to go to a place of rest. You know, they're going to get
sure.
Yeah, you know, they can hold it for a second and get a sneak, you know, extra breath, whatever that metaphor might be. But it's like, nope, we're coming back down. You know, yeah. Don't let those 3 seconds happen. So 3 seconds is, I don't think people think in terms of like that. That's really helpful to make a big difference too.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a constant high intensity effort. It's almost, think about swimming underwater, because really anaerobic exercise really is swimming underwater, isn't it? Okay, so, you know, if you keep coming up for breaths and you say, well, I swam, you know, 4 laps underwater. No, you didn't. You kept coming up for breath. So if we get to this level of fatigue, we want to get there by this constant one effort that builds up metabolites. So mechanically, we want constant effort, which correlates metabolically to building up these this chemical milieu, this chemical mix of soupy stuff to a level that we consider threshold.
I got it. Okay. So here you are, probably the most aware. Were you aware of how I would say smart you were and what you were developing that is kind of revolutionary? I mean,
well, you know, if you think about the whole weightlifting population, I realized I was much smarter than most of those people, but that's a pretty low bar. So just a joke. But anyway, no, but I realized I didn't accept the common thought that you had to do so much work. And Arthur Jones was intricate in that kind of development. But because when we cut down, say, for example, Carl, we cut down from 3 sets of 10 for an exercise to 1 set of 3 or 4, and we still got the same results, then you don't have to be a genius to figure out that the amount of work that you do is not one of the causal intricate factors, right? I mean, we cut it down by 95% and still got to, so the amount of exercises, so what are the other variables? Well, the one other variable that's pretty obvious is intensity. So when I raised the intensity and I lowered the volume, I still got, so now intensity became a very vital contributor to this. And then when you study, so my strength, I think, is that I understand the mechanics and practically, but I also understand the science. So I went back and said, what's my science that's reinforcing the fact that this should work? And it's you look in the basic muscle physiology books, and it says working at the highest level of intensity, highest energy demand, okay, you're looking at, you know, 30 to 90 seconds. And some of that's mechanical, but it's 30 to 60 seconds. And then another energy system has to kick in, okay, which requires us to lower the effort and also use a lower strata of muscle fibers, which are less responsive and promote fewer of the benefits that we want to accrue with exercise.
So jumping back and forth here, because I want to get back to your progression here. I'm thinking of people I know personally. You go, okay, Carl, so I do this twice a week. Mm-hmm. So can I go back to the gym and do other stuff? We said, didn't we just say no? Didn't we say that's not a good idea? And it's like, people that were like 5-day-a-weekers or longer of going
sure,
to the gym.
Sure, yeah.
And you go, you know, I don't mean to like change your whole life, but the answer is still, for the most part, no, you know, unless you're going to walk around the floor and socialize or do something a lot lighter, low intensity or something.
But, yeah, and again, see, here's the thing that you want to get away from, the thought, the common thought that more is better.
Right.
Okay, that's not the case. In almost every case, less is better. Prime example, somebody starts an exercise program, they go 3 or 4 days a week for 20 minutes and a half hour. And then they're starting to slow down with regard to benefit. So what do they normally do? They add more. I'll do more, and they get a little bit of a, okay. But at some point, very shortly in the fitness, the advancement of their fitness, that's the exact wrong thing to do. Instead of doing more, they should do less at a higher intensity. So almost every program that you start works. Why does it work? No matter what, even if it's poorly constructed, because relative to what you've done, you're now demanding a higher strata of muscle work. Okay, walking a mile is going to take more muscular effort than walking 300 yards. But at some point, you get diminishing returns, and that the duration of the exercise becomes counterproductive because it disallows or inhibits intensity, which is really the driving force.
Right.
Okay, because your brain understands that we are creating this life and death situation, I better respond. If you steady state exercise, by definition, it's the most efficient state from at which the muscles can work continuously. Very good for a developing species to survive when they're minimally fed, okay, and had to move for water and shelter and safety. Very good for that species to survive. Very poor for losing weight or driving metabolic upward mobilization.
I hear that. Interesting. Okay, now back to your progression. So how did you pick up then on the low carb part, or whatever they called it back?
I spoke about to Ivor Cummins about this, and he said, how'd you get, you know, I've been doing low carb since 1975, right? And I wrote my first article on fasting in 1978, published it in 78. Anyway, so, you know, for me, this is not new news.
But
you know how I did, how I got into the low carb thing? I was training, and I was a pretty powerful guy and a pretty elite athlete. And a lot of the guys around me were bodybuilders, some of which were world famous. I mean, big time bodybuilders. So I said, these are the leanest people I've ever seen in my freaking life. I said, what do they do? And that was really it. You know, I was asking a racehorse how it ran fast, but, you know, but these guys were doing low before contest for sure. Were doing real low carb. And at that time, high protein. And I've always thought that, in fact, I told this to Peter Attia one time when we had a one-on-one, I said, the best results I've ever seen in my life were with protein-sparing modified fasts. And I don't know if you remember what that stuff was. It was like OptiFast and all that stuff where they would supplement. You would have some flesh food, you know, fish, meat, poultry, and a salad. And the other meals were prepackaged, basically, protein drinks that had, you know, vitamin, mineral. All those. And this was a lot of the bariatric and endocrinologist guys in the 80s. Used this pretty successfully, and I saw great results. But anyway, so, and these were really low carb. There was like almost zero carb, okay? And we were measuring ketones and stuff in the 70s, you know? We got the sticks and all the other stuff. So I said, this worked. And then when I tried it, in other words, I like to look at the, you know, the hypothetical, theoretical basis of this stuff and say, well, okay, that sounds cool. Now let's try it on people. Because some of the stuff that I studied didn't apply when I applied it to people. I did not get the responses I thought I would, so I don't use it. I just wasn't practical, and I don't know what the limitation was. I just couldn't figure it out. But this stuff worked across the board. People lost weight. People's hunger was sated, was satisfied much more readily, and it seemed like they could stick to it. And energy, I mean, I did it myself, and energy was like off the chart. Now, I wasn't that sophisticated in, you know, ketone utilization and, you know, fat being my primary source of fuel so much, except that in real life I saw the benefits. And most of the, and again, you know, I heard somebody say that, you know, losing weight is an offshoot or is a secondary benefit of this stuff. But between you, me, and the lamppost, if weight loss wasn't one of the criteria for which, you know, we could say we could make a dent, I don't think we'd have a low carb movement.
No,
you know, because, you know, I don't give human beings that much credit to think they're going to think about their health and before they think about the cosmetic effect of what they do.
No, that's true. That's true. I hear that 100%. No, I appreciate that. You just reminded me of one of your a line I've listened to in one of your four or five things I've just seen. And you said, I might have been it was at West Palm. And you were saying, you know, you're going to have to, you can differentiate this program, the SMART program, to serve a functional, you know, goal, to serve metabolic goal, to serve a cosmetic goal. So
right.
Recently, the cosmetic goal are kind of the bro science guys. They want the six pack and the arm. They want
Okay.
And so
or the ladies, you know, not I don't want to be sexist, but the women want to lose the fat and be more youthful. Yeah, I got it. Yeah, that's I have no problem with that.
Do you see a big differentiation between? I mean, they're serving the program serves all three purposes.
Yes.
Anyway. And do you differentiate at some point, saying, all right, you know, you also talked to a woman who was going off to do a Spartan race. So you say, well, I have to know more about that, but that's a goal. We can orient it a little bit here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Obviously, if it's a cardio patient, that would be a metabolic, or you know, reversing diabetes, that'd be metabolic, and the cosmetic is the muscle.
Yeah, well, understand. Okay, so again, all of this has to do with that muscle fiber chart. What muscle fibers are we working to what end? Okay, what are we trying? What pathways are we trying to accomplish? and how do we want, what is that going to manifest itself in the end product? Okay, so if we're talking about metabolic, in fact, I think this basic program works in all three. Now, if I want to, and again, for I would say 90% of the population, it's totally sufficient. So if I get a person with reasonable genetics, which always help, okay, and we do this program, I can develop a kid, a gal, a guy, into a pretty muscular specimen, okay? Now, if they want to take it to another end, then we have to start, understand that we're driving that all these four types of muscle fibers to an optimal kind of a level. But now if I want to get that last 10%, say I want a person who needs muscle endurance as opposed to cardiovascular or global endurance. So I may go into those middle fibers that are both aerobic and anaerobic and tax them a little longer. So I may do a couple of exercises for a muscle group, especially a complex muscle group like, say, lats, pecs, you know, delts that have three or four functions. So I may do a couple of exercises instead of one, and I may increase the load time. So I am failing because my glycolytic oxidative combination fibers are failing a little bit. So in other words, I am actually working for muscle endurance, which is going to be something that's required in the performance of whatever it is that they're participating in. So I can manipulate it that way a little bit. And that's kind of torturous. It's hard. Yeah. It's hard to sustain that load time for 2 minutes. I mean, that's a whole different animal. But it's probably more directly related to what we're going to have to sustain and endure in whatever it is that they choose to do as far as their competitive endeavor. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense.
Okay, now, if somebody wants to build muscle, then I have to really get into, if we want to build muscle, we want to make sure that all of those muscle fibers are taxed to the highest extent. That's where we get into maybe, you know, a little more mechanical work, because, and now we're going to have to do more supplementation with protein and maybe hormonal input, not exogenous, you know, not necessarily, although a lot of them are growth hormone and testosterone, but we may have to make sure that those things are at a reasonable level, especially as we get a little older, you know, and that's something. And then our eating has to be, and we may have to do something. We're trying to instigate some interesting signaling pathways at a very high level, and also that recovery has to be specifically completed. I mean, so it gets to become the art of the science gets to be more important than just the pure science. If that makes, you know, there's an art to this thing. Now I have to manipulate, I have to fine tune, I have to personalize very, very specifically for performance or for that body building type of thing. And I knew and worked with some real high level world class bodybuilders, and people thought I was a bodybuilder. I never was, but you know, because I hung with these guys and had a decent physique. But that's like, how do I train a football player? Well, I do the smart system, and then I put them right on the field, and I don't teach them how to get off the blocks. I don't teach them, you know, leverage and positioning and things. No, of course not. That's football. Bodybuilding is different than just growing muscle. Okay, that's a whole different, you know, participation. It's a whole different presentation. This is an exaggeration. There's the problem, and it's not the healthiest thing in the world. If we were to metabolically, these people, now some of these guys I think are insulin resistant, which helps them, because don't forget, insulin drives protein into muscles too. So if you're a little insulin resistant, you know, you're going to be able to probably handle this at a higher level. You're going to be able, and again, that's genetic, but I also want to manifest the most potential I can by manipulating my little routine selectively for that, whatever it is that end product might be.